This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Oh, is it me?
No, it's me. I was just waiting to see if you'd press play.
I was prepping myself.
We're on, aren't we now?
Yeah.
Hello.
I was prepping myself to like open with the big June scream noise music singing.
But you didn't.
But I chickened out at the last second and panicked.
I can't do it very well. But anyway, hello and welcome to Gays on Film. This podcast is where we, a pair of gays, talk about what we're watching. I'm Declan.
And I'm Ned.
And in this episode, we'll be discussing June, part two. Remember, there will be spoilers once we get to the headline feature, so as always, do proceed with caution. But before we get to that, I'm dying to know what you've been watching recently.
You're dying for it. I have continued with my James Bond adventure, and I watched Thunderball the other day, which was about... It was in the Bahamas... I don't know. They've started blurring into one, to be honest.
Maybe you need to have a bit longer of a break between them.
Maybe. I don't want to like lose momentum and just not watch them, though.
Well, no, you've been watching Planet of the Apes for I don't know how long.
I remember enjoying it. I just can't quite remember exactly what the storyline was. Operation Thunderball. Something about the CIA. Oh, I remembered.
Oh.
These are the baddies. Robbed a military aircraft and stole some nuclear warheads out of it and then parked it under the sea near a coral reef and camouflaged it.
What is the name of the Bond girl in this one?
Domino,
right.
Yeah. See, I do remember it.
Yeah.
Enjoyed. I mean, it was...
Are we still on Sean Connery?
Yeah, Sean Connery at the moment. How many did he do?
I think Sean Connery did 5.
Okay, I've got one more then.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I've also watched Tron, the
original 80s one.
1982, I think it came out. And as I was saying to you just before we hit record, really cool visuals. Quite enjoyed the story, actually. But, like, overall production value, it felt very kind of independent budget. Not quite.
It's not
so
the fact
hot.
That it was of its time.
No, there was just something a little bit, clunky in the performances, I think. Not sure. There's just a thing. Anyway, it didn't detract from the overall experience because that was exactly the kind of film I was in the mood for. Anyway, but it's not what I would call mind-blowing cinema.
Why did you pick that?
I've had Tron and Tron Legacy on my watch list for ages, and... Since you went to bed early and said put a film on, I thought now's as good a time as any.
I was trying to listen to it. I was in bed. I was like, I don't recognise what that film is. It doesn't sound like a Bond film.
Some of it was actually quite like funny, but I don't think it was intentionally funny.
Right. I thought you must have seen that like Tron Ares is currently filming. I thought, oh, maybe that's what inspired him.
Yeah, when I said
you weren't even aware there's a new one coming.
There's a third one coming out. I didn't even know. So I'll watch Tron Legacy before too long.
Yeah, I would like to watch Tron Legacy, but I'd quite like to watch Tron as well. So I'll watch it on my own sometime.
Yeah.
Don't want to watch it again.
No. Not in so much.
Just read or something when I'm doing it. Yeah.
What about you? What have you been watching?
Well, I was looking at trying to pull together what I've watched, and a lot of the cinema has been devoted to seeing June Part 2 twice. We have seen some other bits, but we're going to do episodes on them, so I can't talk about them. So I've reverted to telly again. I have officially now both finished Fire and Blood, the George R. R. Martin book, which this is based on,
yeah.
House of the Dragon, and I finished it all, and I cannot wait for season two in June.
That's cute.
It is this whole Targaryen dynasty and how they came to fall is just fascinating.
Ooh.
And they're all backstabbing and everyone's out for their own cause, and it's just, ugh. Love it. Very I love nice. When my fantasies, I think I said this on the previous episode, like proper political.
Yeah.
I really like that kind of stuff. Nice. So yeah, and we've both obviously been ploughing on with Mary and George. I think we're on 3, 4? Can't remember.
We've watched three.
Four.
We've watched yeah. 3 or 4 episodes now.
So yeah, we are watching them. Still on the screeners, actually, that were provided to us by Sky.
Naughty, naughty.
Well, it's not naughty, really it's naughty great.
At all, it's exciting.
And, yeah, I think it's available as a box set for some, so some people seem to have watched it all. But I'm thoroughly enjoying that still. I think yeah. it's great. I think Julianne Moore is just,
yeah.
her line delivery on the delicious script is just...
Delicious.
Great.
Have you seen... this is the trailer I was on about earlier when I said I'd seen one. It's got Nicholas Galitzine and...
Anne Hathaway.
Anne Hathaway.
Yeah.
I saw the trailer and I thought, I feel like I've seen the whole film now.
Well, it's going straight to Amazon as well, so it doesn't scream quality. I think they're a really odd pairing for that as well, Anne Hathaway and Nicholas Galitzine. I don't know why. I keep thinking he's gay because he plays gays all the time.
Gay roles.
But yeah. So yeah, not much really. Well, yeah, a lot of House of the Dragon, but that's all I've got to comment on.
And you really enjoyed it.
Loved it.
Loved it.
I really liked the book.
Loved it. Is that really all we've watched? I suppose we only recorded the podcast a few days ago. A week ago.
Fair.
Yeah.
Feels like longer than that. I don't know why. Don't know. But yeah, no, there's a lot.
Track of time at the moment.
But there's a lot. I did want to talk about Oscars and all sorts, but we're hoping to do an Oscar special where we're going to cover Poor Things out soon.
I thought we decided that since we didn't record before.
No, I'm going to do the news, as in special. I'm going to talk about the winners.
Right.
A little bit. Okay. I won't go on too much. Like you tell me once the mic goes off. You went on a bit much about those awards.
You just
awards.
Go through every single category.
Well, I think I go
nominee.
In it thinking I'm going to just stick to the main ones and then I get all excited. Like, best VFX was Godzilla Minus One and I'm obsessed with the fact that Godzilla Minus One won an Oscar.
And but... I love knowing that, but I don't need to know all of the nominees for all of the rest of the categories
as well.
Well,
we won't.
You know what
won't.
I mean?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. What about in the news for this episode?
Well, this is hot off the press as of recording today.
Hot.
The strikes are still having an effect on Hollywood. And I thought this was going to come because who plays... Not Batman. Who plays... Why is the... Am I having a complete... Jeffrey Wright was in Batman. The Batman.
Was he?
Yeah.
Well, if you say so, yeah.
And
I like Jeffrey Wright.
He's kept saying in his press when he's been on the press tour about American Fiction and he keeps getting asked about Batman Part 2. Has he seen the script? And he's like, no, I've not seen it yet. And I thought, that should be filming soon if it's out in October next year. Especially because the filming of that kind of film takes like quite a lot of months. And apparently, because... So yeah, we're talking about the Batman Part 2. Apparently due to the writer's strike, which meant that Matt Reeves had months where he couldn't work on the script, Warner Brothers have delayed it a full year. A full year.
Would you not rather they delayed it a full year and made
yeah,
it good?
Yeah, I know. I just want to go back to a time in Hollywood where when they slated summer, it stuck. But ever since 2020, it's just become this new landscape where, like, everything... never seems set until you're about 2 months before release and then it seems pretty set in.
Right.
So obviously we had COVID pushing everything back. I'll never forget when No Time to Die was pushed back and it felt like the world was ending. I was like, oh God, it's coming for the cinema now. This is really serious. but yeah, I just pine for a time where things, when they get dated, they stick to it. But I do think this might be a good thing for what DC are trying to do, because obviously the Batman, Robert Pattinson's Batman, is going to be an Elseworlds story that's not part of the new DCU.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, we're getting Superman, what was called Superman Legacy next year, which has now just been retitled to simply Superman, in July next year. It might give the new DCU a bit of space to breathe and find its space, rather than having that in July and then, oh, we've got another DC film in October, but it's not
maybe
the same universe and all that kind of stuff.
Maybe they're taking notes from people's frustration with the MCU, trying to like stave off the fatigue before it happens.
Yeah.
Who knows?
But it has gone a full year, so it's been bumped till October 2026.
Right.
Which feels like forever away. Well, it is, really. But, so it's been pushed back till then. But I'm quite glad it's kept its October release date, because I think that Batman, this version of Batman, is a autumn-y film.
Mm. I mean, it was very rainy and dark.
It was just, yeah. And I remember the original the first one kept moving release dates due to COVID. And I think that came out in the autumn. I just thought it was a perfect autumn film.
Okay.
I find it really strange. I think some films belong in, like, certain times of the year.
Yeah.
Because there's one out this year, and I don't think it sounds like a film that everyone goes to see during Christmas time. Mufasa. It feels like summer to me, that, a Lion King film.
Yeah.
Know what I mean?
I do, yeah.
And I remember when the Fantastic Four, this is really segueing, but when the Fantastic Four was dated for like November before, I was like, Fantastic Four is not a November film. I don't know when it's dated for now, but
maybe
it's not
you're
November.
In the wrong job, you.
Maybe I would love to be a movie scheduler, looking for when, oh, the studio might be releasing that there, so we need to avoid that weekend. We need to, yeah. But yeah. Nerd.
Right then, what a time we've had. But now it's time to cast our minds into the future and get excited for what's coming up in the world of it's film, isn't it?
I just say film and TV because it's just...
Well, yeah,
don't matter.
I do.
But
think
I think this is the film.
Traumatised from times when you've caught me out. The world of film and TV. It's time now for Trailer, Trash or Treasure. What have we got this week, King?
Well, it's a film called The Wild Robot. I know absolutely nothing else about it other than its title, because I've just panicked and picked a trailer because there don't seem to be many trailers at the minute. So, yeah.
Grand. Well, the link to that is in the show notes. If you would like to pause this and watch along with us, see us back
again.
After the sparkles.
Oh, God. Right. Bye.
Bye. Oh, wasn't that cute?
It does look really cute. It gives me, like, Iron Giant meets Wall-E vibes.
Yeah. And I like that animation style. It's, like, illustrated, but obviously...
It very much follows this ilk of what's going on in animation at the minute, being
yeah.
a bit more creative with
more
the
like
style.
Stylized.
Yeah,
very much like that. It looks to be something that's very in touch with nature.
Yeah, it says emotional. It follows this robot, ROSM, Unit 7134, ROS for short, shipwrecked on an uninhabited island and must learn to adapt to the harsh surroundings, gradually building relationships with the animals on the island and becoming the adoptive parent of an orphaned gosling. It looks really cute. It
does look really cute.
And we hear Lupita Nyong'o's voice, but the rest of the voice cast, which we don't hear in this, includes the likes of Pedro Pascal, Catherine O'Hara, Bill Nighy, Kit Connor and Stephanie Hsu.
Oh, great. Love all of them.
So, yeah, we don't see them. Maybe the animals talk. I don't know.
Maybe they do.
But, yeah, it looks really sweet. Apparently, it's based on a book series of the same name.
Aww.
Yeah, it looks really cute. He does, like, the author, they're like an illustrated type.
Cute.
book. Mr. Tiger Goes Wild. I think I've seen those books. I think the children's books, maybe.
I mean, same author. The Wild Robots.
No, this is the World, the Wild Robot books that he's done. But yeah, US release date is September. I'm sure we'll get it at around the same time in the UK.
Yes.
But yeah, people are saying it looks, or even said, like it gives BB-8, Wall-E, Baymax, Iron Giant vibes.
All of the above.
And I like the song, like the nice slowed down What a Wonderful World.
Yeah, that was nice.
Yeah, it's a nice trailer. I'd give it a treasure.
Just what I needed on this Tuesday evening.
Yeah.
Treasure from me as well.
Cool.
Grand. Well, now it's time for this week's headline feature. Dune Part 2 coming up right after this quick break.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Dune Part 2.
My Dune. My Arrakis. Yeah. I have decided to not do notes for this film.
Because
I know I can confidently talk about it because I've seen it twice now as well. And there's a lot I want to say. And I thought my notes could make me almost say too much and rein it in a bit.
I did. I did start to write notes, and I'd been writing for a fair number of minutes before I thought I've probably got enough notes.
Yeah. But before we dive into that then, do you want to give us a synopsis?
Yes. I think I've got a relatively good one.
Yeah.
Which almost certainly doesn't do the film justice. Having escaped the Harkonnen raid on Arrakeen, rumoured to have ended the Atreides bloodline, Paul and Jessica are living among the Fremen, many of whom believe Paul to be their messiah. As Bene Gesserit prophecies unfold, imperial structures of wealth and power are threatened.
I agree. Well, I don't really know where to start other than the fact that it is a cinematic masterpiece of a film.
Oh my god, it's gorgeous.
It can't be talked about. I'm going to get into where I would rate it. We're going to get into things I liked and I didn't like. But you cannot dispute that Denis Villeneuve has accomplished something with this film that we don't see very often.
Friggin' smashed it.
Like when I was seeing reviews when people were like, this is, you know, this is the Lord of the Rings level of filmmaking, I would say, yeah, I can pretty much get behind that. And if we're going off that, we're saying this kind of filmmaking only comes around once every 20 years. That's what we're kind of saying.
That is what we're saying. Yeah, I think it's brilliant. And I think it perfectly complements Part 1. Like, as a pair, they're a fantastic.
Well, I loved Part 1, but I do understand some people's criticisms of Part 1 that it does feel very much a setup, which it does, but I still think it feels like a complete film in itself.
Yeah, I mean, it ends on a bit of a what happens next question.
But loads of films do in a series, don't they?
I think that, because I've started reading the book now, as you well know, and I'm racing through it because it's really, really good. And I think, sort of reading it after having seen both the films, I can pick out, like, the choice, like, why Part 1 was much more world-building. And although it had the story, I don't think its primary function was driving the plot forward particularly.
I was worried I was going to miss that level of world building. Yeah, and I did in a sense, because I think when I rewatched Dune Part 1, I just liked being on Arrakis and seeing how it worked and learning about this planet.
Yeah.
And we don't learn everything about the Fremen culture, but we start to see parts of things.
Yeah, yeah.
But this
we kind
one,
of learn as the Atreides.
Yeah,
learn,
but this cool. one built on that even more. Like, yeah. again, the way they use water, like everything that everyone that they kill, they take the water from them.
Yeah.
They don't drink it because it's spoiled, and they put it in that big bath of water, the holy kind of water in that big.
No, I think you're mixing customs there.
Where do they put the water from the Harkonnens?
The water from the Harkonnens is like coolant for the stillsuits, but it's not drinking water. And the water from the Fremen is
when
like
they die, go into the.
So it goes into.
Oh,
the...
I did think that yeah. actually. Yeah,
they don't mix the. They take water into that.
Jamis's
water.
Water and put it in there, yeah. don't they? But I knew. I thought it was a really clever choice, especially having read the book, because in the book, each chapter starts with Princess Arulan, almost like an excerpt of one of her kind of journals.
Diaries, yeah.
And the film kind of, it touches a little bit on that first, but I wouldn't say that's the opening scene. The main opening scene to me is we kind of pick up where we left off with Lady Jessica and Paul with the Fremen. And I just could feel that scene where this troop of Harkonnens attack. The way it was shot, the way it looked, I just thought...
Oh, it was so cool.
Just all my nerves were just totally dissipated because it was like, even when the shots of when the Harkonnens, when they can fly...
And they were like,
I thought,
oh,
that
up.
Looks fun.
They were like scaling the rock,
yeah.
weren't they? But floating up it.
But even when they're at the top and the Fremen started shooting at them, small details, like even the sound design was so good.
Oh, I know.
I thought, we are in for a treat with
yeah.
it. I felt totally at ease with it all.
Yeah.
And I just thought, fucking hell, this is just. Phenomenal filmmaking.
Yeah.
That scene, I'd love to have seen what it looked like when it was shot, because I guarantee, obviously, that the light when they were shooting it wasn't like that. That's been done in the edit, but I'd
oh,
love to
yeah.
have seen. Was it middle of the day? Was it dawn? Was it dusk? Like, I'd need to ask Denis.
Oh, do you know what? Speaking of like visual effects, you know when we went to. I'm jumping through the story a tad.
That's fine.
When we went to the Harkonnen place and Fade Rotha. Was doing his like gladiator shenanigans
yeah.
and everything's black and white. Apparently that wasn't filmed in black and white, it was filmed in infrared.
It was.
Way cool.
And I didn't realize that creative decision as well. It's not just for no reason, it's because their planet
yeah.
has a black sun.
Do you know, actually, reading more of the book and like getting senses of that, I'm like, maybe I could have had some of that in the film. Like, I want to know a bit more about where the Harkonnens are from. But it just sort of went to this black
I think
and white
them deciding to do
bit.
These as films rather than like a longer form TV show.
Yeah.
They're the kind of creative decisions where it's like it would be nice to have, but the film would be 5 hours long.
Maybe they could do like what Lord of the Rings did and do an extended edition for the big nerds.
Well, it's funny you say that. Denis Villeneuve has actually discussed that and said he does not believe in edited scenes or deleted scenes. If he wanted them to be in the film... They would be in the film.
Okay. Well,
which I thought
I
was
want
quite
them
interesting.
To be in the film.
I loved the fireworks that they had on that planet.
Yeah. They were like.
They were like ink blots, like.
They were like when somebody pops a massive spot and it goes.
Oh. In black.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Because they weren't just an explosion, they were like wet.
Yeah, I get what you mean.
Yeah.
Like a wet pump.
Oh.
I don't really... Like, and I'll say this as well, talking about VFX.
Mm.
This budget, 190 million. We see films that are way more expensive that have horrendous CGI. And I think it just goes to show if you've got a vision, and I think this film had very little... studio interference as well. I
yeah.
think Warner Brothers literally went, we believe in you, go yeah. for it. I think to cost that much and for it to look like it did is another achievement as well.
Oh, definitely. Like,
that scene where he learns to ride the worm.
Oh my God, baby's first sandworm ride.
Not that big.
That was so cool. And even the second time through, it gave me like, I was on the edge of my seat and I was getting like goosebumps because it was really like tense and important. And oh, it was so much fun. I like that. I'm really curious to know how they get off the sandworms though.
So am I. And on, other than when it's just one person.
Yeah, I kind of, yeah, I get the mechanics of one person doing it. But then
when
like,
Lady Jessica was on that carriage, Jessica, I was like, has she done that?
Really, really pregnant and we have to get you to the south. Do you fancy hopping on this worm in this box? How are they doing that?
I don't know. It's like, I just envisioned them just lobbing this thing with Lady Jessica in it,
also,
on it onto this worm.
I do also have a question. Why does the sandworm, when it's got somebody on it, not go underground?
I think what I've read, because I thought, are they steering it? Are they doing, like...
Because I think they do steer
it. I think they do. I think there's obviously some just sort of connection between the people who are on from that indigenous to that planet and the indigenous
like the
wildlife.
Navi of Avatar.
That's kind of what that's where my head's kind of settled it. Because I did think that myself. So when, oh, that was weird. When he put
His hooks
in and he pulled it up and it had like hairy nose hairs. Like I was nostril. Like, oh.
Maybe that's like, why. Maybe it's like, oh, my nostrils are open. I can't go under the sand.
Maybe. But I've just thought it's like a Navi.
Okay, yeah.
You know, to their indigenous
planet. I'm on board
planet,
with any of those
Pandora.
Theories.
I want to talk more about kind of the overall themes of this, not just this film, but this franchise. Because a lot of people say, obviously, there are similarities to this and what happens in the world from a colonialism perspective.
Yeah.
People, all these great houses fighting over a planet for its resources.
Yeah.
It could be somewhere in the Middle East, let's say, where the West has gone in and pillaged it or wherever.
Well, I mean, there is something to be said about how much of the... like a lot of the folklore that the Fremen have uses words that I don't know if they are Arabic words, but they definitely sound like Arabic words to someone who doesn't speak Arabic. So I don't think it's a million miles from that. I saw one headline, but I didn't read the thing because I was at work. And it was asking the question as to whether Dune has appropriated Arabic language for its purposes. So I think, you know, to respond to your point that this could be somewhere in the Middle East.
Well, even like the costumes of the Fremen does feel a bit Arabic.
Very deserty, isn't it?
Yeah. But I will say for that theme, and yeah, it can open conversations, but we've seen that kind of in other films as well about that, and in science fiction where it's like taking real world examples and planting it. But what I don't think we see very often is this kind of messiah, false prophets, prophecy type things very often.
I know, it's really quite... I can see why it's a provocative theme. Because, I mean, the conclusion that we're led to draw in Dune is that for, I don't know how many generations of history, the Bene Gesserit have been... like planting prophecies.
They say they have
there.
Their plans are made in thousands of years. Like
yeah.
They breed across different lines. Yeah,
they essentially manage the human gene pool, and in order to do that over long periods of time, have to set up like folklore and mythology, and essentially what becomes religion.
What I can't necessarily get my head around is what of the Bene Gesserit. Why do they want to do it? Is it just religion? Because I was like, why have they done this? Like,
Yeah, I don't really know.
Like, what is their motivation to... Is it literally just kind of religious power?
I was hoping that would be sort of a bit more involved in the book, but, I mean, if you're
No, I don't think it does.
Maybe it's not.
And, I mean, I did finish the book a few weeks ago now, so I have probably forgotten some of it, but I really liked from that, looking at prophecy, I did like Charney's characterization and almost like... I felt like I was having similar reactions to her.
Yeah.
As a viewer.
Yeah.
It's like, this prophecy is how they enslave us. This has got, like, this is really silly that this is this Maudib. Lisan Al Gaib. So. I found that really interesting, and that does differ from the book a bit, because Charney's not quite as sceptical, and I do remember, I thought it was quite interesting that, like, the people from the south were the, what do they call them?
Fundamentalists,
and then the north were a bit more sceptical and a bit more kind of, but that isn't really touched on in the book, and I really like that scene where we see when Lady Jessica's drank the water of life, and they're all stood outside waiting to see what happens to her.
Mm.
And you've got Javier Bardem as
Stilgar
and his southern cronies all like worshipping, we need to pray. Then you've got Charney and some of her northern fellows kind of, oh, this is all really silly, just laughing about stuff. And I did think that kind of dichotomy between they kind of all believe in some sort of religion, but some people take it a lot more seriously than others.
It sort of hints towards the difference between culture and religion. Because a lot of the things that are important culturally to the Fremen are still respected regardless of if you believe in the prophecies.
Yeah.
And then there are people whose kind of prayers are around the prophecies and things. But they're all still part of the same Fremen cause. They just have different perspectives or approaches.
Yeah. You know what I mean? And I thought, having watched it twice now, I think this movie skips along quite quick as well.
Well, I've noticed that the second time watching it as well. It kind of jumped through.
It's like Lady Jessica drinks this water of life where I just always want to go, water of life Jesus gave us, which I guess is, you know, on
Messiah.
What's the, like, not the Messiah, is it messianic or something?
Messianic,
that's it,
I think.
But I thought, oh, she's done it right, we move on. There wasn't really, like,
well, the only kind of point of reference you had for the passage of time here was the size of her pregnant belly, really, because other than that, the timeline could have been weeks or it could have been years.
Yeah, because in the book, I think Jessica and Paul are with the Fremen. Well, they're with the Fremen long enough for Charney to get pregnant and have the child with Paul.
I've not got that far yet.
No, but we discussed it at the table when we
saw
it with our friends, which was omitted from this story, but I do think it was...
It wouldn't have translated well enough into a film that would have made enough sense without all of the around explanation that you get from the book.
Yeah, and I think, the passage of time, like, he goes into the desert to learn the ways, but it's like, how long is he in the desert for?
How long does it take to learn the ways?
Because the way it's done is like, it's like Charney follows Paul and it feels like it's the same day and she's just followed him. But...
Yeah.
But yeah, no, that I hadn't clocked that at Lady Jessica's belly. It's quite, for a film that deals with quite complex themes, I would say, it's become quite memeable and quite like...
Oh, there's loads going on there.
Like, I did think Stilgar was amazing comic relief at times because it is quite heavy and it's not a film, it's not a franchise.
Drink every time Stilgar says, as written.
I know, it's like, and I've seen that on loads of stuff, like people putting that as memes. Oh, but also, like, like Lady Jessica talking to the baby. You know, like how still I might do a Gollum impression or stuff.
Yeah.
Like, it's like there's things in this that you can see will stay in popular culture.
Yeah.
So a lot of what Stilgar says, like, Lisa Nagaib, or as it is written, like the way Jessica talks to the baby, like the baby's like, I want me dinner. Shut up. No, you don't. And then the way when they use the voice, when I go to you, make me a cup of tea.
Yeah.
Like there's things that they've done. And this is where, you know, when people go, sorry to, I know you've been trying to get a point out, but you know, when people go, ah, this film's just been made to make memes from it. No. The way the world is now, if it's a good film and it permeates itself into pop culture, it'll just happen.
It's not like the music industry, which is manufacturing music for
TikTok. Yeah. Denis Villeneuve did not go, oh, this scene will be good on Twitter.
No.
Didn't happen.
No.
Just organically happened. So
it's good.
Yeah.
What did you think about the shots of the fetus?
They were weird.
It first cropped up and I was like, oh, is it going to be this kind of... Are we going to see a lot of fetus and narration while we're seeing kind of shots of...
You know, like, what I thought the second time? Things. I was like, oh, the pro-lifers in America are going to get hold of this film and use it. I was like, if that baby can speak after about 4 days of being pregnant, then...
Anyway...
But no, it was a weird, like...
It threw me a little bit the first time before I really knew what was happening. But then the second time watching it, I was like, okay, like, I know where we're going with this. I was nervous when we got the second shot of the baby that I thought it might get a bit weird. But actually, I don't think it did. I think it was quite a cool intro, I suppose.
Well, if she's talking to the baby,
it
would have been a bit weird if they hadn't showed something.
Yeah,
she's just like looking down at
the
belly going,
when she drank the water of life.
Oh, that was a weird.
And
the water,
you saw like the poison go into the amniotic fluid, and then the Reverend Mother, who was like passing the responsibility to Jessica, was like, "Oh fuck, she's pregnant."
Yeah, that was a bit of a criticism because she goes, "What have we done?"
Yeah.
But
then nothing else really comes out.
Well, what have you done?
Yeah, don't know.
What about her being pregnant? Like,
I think that might be revealed in the third film.
Well, so do I. But
because, from what I understand, becoming a Reverend Mother means, like, taking on the memories of every Reverend Mother that came before you.
Yeah.
And you usually do that when you're ready to become that. But now, the baby that Jessica is carrying has that from before birth, so she's going to be a Reverend Mother from birth, in theory.
Yeah, which I'm going to spoil the book a bit again, but Aaliyah is born,
yeah,
and is a young child in the book, but has like the wisdom, is like she is a child, but she doesn't act like a child, like the way she speaks, like, so it's almost a bit like
old beyond her years.
Yeah, so that is, instead of being out in the world, is still inside of Jessica. And obviously, we've got Anya Taylor-Joy, who I kind of thought, I think when she rocked up at the premiere, I was like, I think she's going to be Aaliyah. And she was, but she was literally in it for...
Blink and you'll miss her.
Yeah. I don't even think she was credited in the credits.
She's got four words.
But she will be a bigger part of the next film, I'm sure.
Yeah, I get that.
There was a few people that apparently Denis Villeneuve was like, I really want to cast you, but know that part two, you won't be in it a lot, such as... Florence Pugh as Princess Irulan.
I thought she was so good.
She is.
I was thinking about her earlier on the train, and I was like, she is just so flawless, like, as a person. And I don't think I've seen her in a film and thought, that wasn't that great.
I think that
and I see
this
her on the red
franchise,
and she's so, like, gorgeous and poised and
but really, like, normal.
Cool. And like, yeah, you
she
just,
was getting interviewed at the Oscars the other night, and I was like, oh, you're proper normal. Yeah. But like, again, talking about some of the stars in this, like having that kind of older crop of talent, you know, Christopher Walken, who's a
legend. Love him in this.
Not in it much, but
no,
he does the job.
What he does is really good.
I swear he came out of retirement for this film.
Did he? Oh, yeah. I would.
Yeah.
I liked some of his outfits. He was very... It was very, like, sci-fi emperor.
Do you know what it reminded me of? Something made me... A few parts of this film made me giggle, but it wasn't
Not because it was funny.
It was like, this is like weird sci-fi. Like, this is... The fact that this has become as popular as it had blows my mind. But when he's at the end and he's laid on the steps and he's being killed, his little shoes sticking up on the on those steps made me laugh. I don't know why.
Stellan Skarsgård?
No. The Emperor.
He gets killed?
Yeah, Paul stabs him in the neck.
Does he? No.
No, he doesn't.
No, he doesn't.
Well, he gets... Am I on about Stellan Skarsgård?
You're on about Harkonnen. Stellan Skarsgård.
His little shoes when he's laid on the thing, when he's like this big floaty
his
man.
His whole thing is funny because he's just a big fat balloon.
I know, and he bathes in his balsamic vinegar and olive oil and yeah. He's a good villain, him.
He is a really good villain.
I actually find all of the Harkonnens really quite like...
Oh my god, Austin Butler as Fade Rother.
Yeah.
He was really good.
Really, really good. Yeah. I actually wish he'd been in it a little bit more.
Yeah. That's what I mean, like, I could have benefited from understanding where the Harkonnens are from a bit more just for having Fade Rother in it. Like, there's been a few conversations in the book that I'm like, oh, that could have probably made a good scene and given me a little bit more of a taste of the Harkonnen evil, you know what I mean? Like, there's just a few bits of that. And I also can't work out yet who Dave Bautista played.
Robin.
Yeah, I know, but like, I don't.
So he's
don't
the
know
nephew.
If I've met him yet.
He's the huh?
I don't know if I've met him yet in the book.
Oh, in the book. I thought you meant in the film. I was like,
no,
he's in it,
obviously,
loads.
I've played
it.
Yeah.
He's the Baron's nephew and Fade Rother's brother.
Yeah.
I tell you what, who I did think was really cool, even in the short time she was in it. Lea Seydoux. She was Margot Fenring.
Yeah.
I thought it was a bit rude, you know.
What?
So obviously, the Bene Gesserit's big plan is they didn't just have Paul as a potential, they also had others.
Yeah, they got some backups, just
and
in
she
case.
Obviously...
Seduced Fade Rother.
But it looked, you know, it was getting a bit sexy.
Yeah.
And then she does the whole Gom Jabbar thing that the other lady did to...
Oh, and she goes...
She went, put your hand in the box. I was like...
I just got that.
I was like, oh my God, you dirty bugger. I was like... And then you see the knife. At his, I was like, oh, she's not talking
so
about
naughty.
That. She's talking about the box to test him. So obviously he passes the test as well.
Yeah.
I still love that sequence from the first film. I thought it was amazing.
Yeah.
Really like Charlotte Rampling as the head, like the big Bene Gesserit Reverend Mother.
Oh yeah, oh, my God, that made me laugh as well when Paul turned to her and went and was like,
"What does
silence!
She say? What does she
and
say
she,
before that?"
She like fell over. And
be
went,
careful what you
abomination. Oh my God, it was so
what did
funny.
She say? She said. What she said before he says silence, be careful what you're about to do, Paul Atreides. Silence! And she was like, abomination. But I tell you whose face I loved when Paul used the voice there. Fade Rother, Austin Butler, does this like slight smirk, like he finds all this quite
funny.
But he almost looked a bit turned on by it as well, like the
Ooh,
face he did. Like, because Fade Rother, he is psychotic, like as Princess Aurelian says, he's psychotic. But he is, and I just think he does it so well.
Yeah. Speaking of Princess, how do you say her name?
Irulan.
So I've been saying Irulan in my
Irulan,
head
probably that.
It.
Irulan.
Anyway,
yeah.
Costume design.
Oh,
for
I mean,
her.
All the costumes,
amazing.
But they were, yeah.
Other costumes of note, Jessica as the Reverend Mother. Has all these like chains and beads and oh, she just looks really cool.
I think like this is
what did Josh said it was giving Apocalypse Now.
Maybe
is that the reference? Don't know. Yeah, I think so.
I actually think Rebecca Ferguson's performance is maybe my favourite of the film.
Do you know? There's, I agree. Performance-wise, but there's something about Jessica that I don't think I quite get on with.
Well...
And it's like, it's not a criticism of the film because it's like definitely a character trait that she has. I can't quite like put it into words. I've been thinking about it for so long, and it still happens in the book as well. So it's definitely like,
well, I've got a few, about it. I wasn't going to get towards the end, but I find the characters in this, I don't think anyone is particularly likable. I thought they made Charney a bit more likable than what's in the book, because she's a bit against it. And we're, as I said previously, we're like, I felt like I was having similar reactions to what she's going through. I quite like Gurney Halleck.
Oh, he's likable.
Smile, Gurney. I am smiling. But the rest of them, like the big important players, I don't like Paul.
Not Stilgar.
No, he's stupid. He's an idiot. He's an idiot.
He's not. He teaches Paul how to be a Fremen.
Yeah, he might teach him that, but Paul could have a shit in the desert and he'd be like, Lys and Al-Ghaib. Like, no. Like, a lot of their... I don't think that many of them are particularly, you know, really likeable characters. And that's one of my criticisms. And I find this really difficult because when I watched it again, I was like, it's a fucking spectacle of a film. It's amazingly shot, like everything about it is amazing. Like the fact that Denis has even managed to adapt it the way he has, you know, one of the very few filmmakers I would say that takes a really famous book and probably makes it even better, like Peter Jackson did for The Lord of the Rings, like leaving some things out, making some creative decisions, but still telling the overall story. Yeah. Right? But my criticism is, I don't feel invested.
Don't you?
No.
No idea. I'm hooked.
I'm hooked. But not because I'm not invested in Paul. Even though I find his journey in this film going from where he leans into that. Yeah. I am the Messiah.
He starts with a really interesting like disdain for power, and then almost in the blink of an eye, there's a real shift in the way he's addressing it. And I think it's less to do with taking his role as the Messiah and more to do with recognizing that in order for like the Emperor and the Harkonnens and the Spacing Guild to not have such a hold over do they live in a galaxy?
Let's say that.
We'll call it a galaxy. It feels like very Star Wars to say that. Yeah. To not have such a hold over the galaxy, he's going to have to take some of that power, so he might as well get behind that.
So interesting what you're saying.
Because I've not finished the book yet.
No, because you don't know what's coming next.
No. So that's where I'm at currently with it. But I think it's really interesting. The emotional core. I know what you mean about
Denis Villeneuve being
fully on.
Let us have scenes where we're exploring Paul and Charney's relationship. You know, he did cut to scenes where it was just them two spending some time.
Yeah.
And I did find it on the second viewing slightly more like when they're walking through the desert and they're both doing that funny walk together.
The sand walk.
The sand walk and that lovely score that, I mean, doesn't even really need to be talked about, does it? Hans Zimmer's fucking phenomenal score again. But when they're both doing that, is it A Quiet Between the Storms and they have a kiss and they're doing all that. But I thought, even then, at the end, when we hear that he's going to take Paul will marry Princess Irulan, it left me cold. I can't describe it. I didn't see them as like loads of people have interviewed for this film. They're like, really, this is a love story, but I didn't feel that at all.
No, I think I did feel it. I think what the ending did though, because I think maybe I could describe the feeling I was left as cold as far as Paul and Charney's relationship is, but I think what it did by finishing with that is leave us in a similar mood to where part one left us, where Paul and Jessica had literally just met the Atreides and...
The Atreides?
No, not the Atreides, the Fremen, sorry.
Mm.
And Paul obviously won in that like combat with Jamis. And then you're like, okay, but like what's now. I want to know what's now for Charney.
Yeah, I can't describe, like, I just think, oh, it's meant to be a love story between these two. It failed me on that. She looked, like, gutted.
I really liked...
That she was taking... And obviously he does say lines like, I'll always love you or whatever, that kind of stuff. Because he has drank the water at this point, so he knows the route he has to take to get what he wants. So he knows what's coming. Mm. But I was just like, I do not... When she walked out of that when everyone else is bowing, did not feel that emotion. And we were with a friend of ours who's read the books as well. And she was crying.
Hi, Becca.
And she was crying. And yeah. I was like, have I missed something? Because it just didn't do that for me at all.
No, yeah.
And that's where my star rating comes, where it's not the perfect that I thought it was going to be. Because the film has represented itself as this is a romance. But I felt everything but the romance, personally. Okay.
I'm not about to tell you you're wrong or anything. Like, your perspective is, of course, valid. But I did get all of those things that you're missing from it. So I don't know what...
I'm not the only person who I've spoke to who...
No, I know. Yeah. I just think maybe, I don't know, people just see things differently, don't they?
I don't know. I always maybe feel... I always want to... If it's romance, I want to feel, like, warm and fuzzy. But doesn't make me feel
romance
like that.
Isn't always about
no, I know, but a lot. Of, no, but I think he wanted us to make that us feel like their relationship was like that amongst all this, and I just didn't. But let's move on from that because we've gone on a lot about that. I loved some of the action scenes.
Oh my God!
When they've all got those snorkels through the sand and the they're like little breathing contractions,
yeah,
and then
really
they all
cool.
jump up to take out that
and the
spice.
Little mouse is like sniffing at Paul's one.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cute.
Parallels. But the third act is like, it's a war film, basically.
Yeah. Oh my God, so cool.
Yeah. The production design and what those ships looked like, the when the Emperor landed and
I
stuff,
know.
I was like, this is so cool.
I really like I just really like how they've designed like the shields that are around ships and people. Like,
oh, that
and
ship.
And it like distorts...
When the storm was going past it.
The big silver globe that the Emperor
was in.
Arrives in with all his, like, entourage, I don't know what you'd call
it. The Sardaukar.
And it's, like, a big pyramid underneath it. The globe is suspended, and then the storm is blowing past it, and the way the sand and the spice are interacting with the shield just looks... so cool. It's like it's on fire, but
yeah,
not.
But it's not. No,
and then,
it's cool.
Actually, do you know what really threw me? And it's not, it can't be a criticism of the film because it's literally pulled straight from the books. They've got nuclear warheads.
Yeah, I know.
Random.
It is random as well, because I swear the book was written in 62.
It's so random.
Wasn't that just at the start of the, like, nuclear proliferation as well?
Well, I mean, nuclear warheads have been around since World War II.
Yeah, but... Like, the cold... I don't know. It's like, where's he got that theme from? Because that's very, like, Cold War type stuff.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Mad.
I thought it was... It's a lot to talk about. And I do... There's a shot in this film that could be on a poster. When Paul comes to the south. And he's got his veil over him. And he stands amongst the crowd. It's like something you would see in, like, The Passion of Christ. He's, like, surrounded by them all. All the Fremen, thousands of them.
Yeah.
As he's going into the cave, into the siege.
Literally can't remember.
Oh, I need to find.
Like, I remember the crowd, but I can't think what shot you're saying that is any more impressive than almost any.
But it's all zoomed out, and he's stood in the middle of a crowd, and there's just thousands of them.
Okay.
It's beautiful.
I mean, loads of it's beautiful.
No,
I'm not saying it's not beautiful, but. He's a random one to pull out.
He's a phenomenal cinematographer, Greg Fraser.
Yeah.
Greg Fraser. If you look at some of the stuff he's done recently, The Batman, The Creator, one of your favourite films of last year.
Oh my God, another... We were talking about the combat. Another thing I would like to nod to in costume design. You know, the gladiating scene And there's, like, obviously Fader Author and the three Atreides.
Are you going to talk those, about them guard things?
The guard things.
The little...
They look a little bit like Xenomorphy type people.
They were really cool costumes.
They were so
they
cool.
They were cool. Yeah,
and
I agree.
And one of them puts his hook in the back of...
Yeah, stand back!
Yeah.
Oh, really cool. Yeah.
Really cool.
But yeah, that's... I mean, we've talked about a lot now. We've been going on a while. I don't know if we kind of...
Well, we could either call it a day now or start going over, like, minutia.
Furthia Howard was cut out of it. I'm sad about that.
Yeah, I've been wondering where he was.
Stephen McKinley Henderson, the one who rolls his eyes to the...
Yeah.
So he did film scenes, but didn't
did
make the cut.
Didn't make
yeah.
It.
And he's an important part in the book
as
well. I've
just read quite a significant chapter for him in the book, actually. Well, I won't ruin it for those who haven't read.
Oh, I mean, you can't do spoilers. It came out in the 60s, for God's sake.
No, but people might be like, oh, I'll read the book.
So let's go towards the end of the film then, right?
Okay.
Let's tie this... Let's bring the ship in.
Yes.
He started the Holy War.
I know. What else do you want to say about it?
Who knows what's coming? I do.
Have you read Messiah yet?
I know what comes in Messiah. I haven't read it, but I do know what comes. And it goes in some... I tell you...
I might read it straight after I'm done with...
If Dune Part 1 is hard to adapt, especially for a modern audience perspective, Dune Messiah is on another level.
How is it?
Yeah. But I am interested to see how he does it, because there is quite a jump in time, but I don't know if he's going to do that.
Will they require ageing?
I don't think so, because I think Denis said he wants to do... Well, the script's pretty much written, and he apparently Hans Zimmer just kept scoring more and more stuff.
Of course he did.
But I think he said he wants to do at least one other project, if not two, before he gets to Dune Part 3.
Oh, so
there might be...
Wait a while.
We haven't talked about, actually... I mean, there's some other performances we haven't touched on. But we haven't touched on Timothée Chalamet.
At all, actually.
Did phenomenal. Like,
brilliant.
Even the way his character slightly changes when he leans into becoming that messianic role, the prophet.
Yeah.
Like, even the way he holds his face, I thought, looked slightly different. And everything, I thought, that kind of really subtle, but... Oh God, he's turned a bit here.
Yeah.
Thought it was really interesting.
Yeah.
And
I think his characterization's really cool. From the source material, because there's lots of like subtleties in the way that that he's acted in the film that look really cool, like as when you're watching it, but then when I'm reading Paul Atreides. And I'm seeing, obviously, Timothée Chalamet as Paul Atreides. A lot of the subtleties in the on-screen performance are being explained in the words of the book, where obviously they're not kind of explicit in the film because you can't really narrate all of the inner words.
Well, exactly. A lot of the book is from, like,
but that's what
Paul's
I mean. Like,
inner
it's
voice,
such,
isn't it? So,
it's such
yeah.
interesting characterization in the film to have all of that from the book without having any of it from the book. You know what I mean? Very cool. I think it's very skillfully done. Yes.
Star rating?
5. Yeah. Another 5. I gave the first one a 5 and I think this is perfectly matched. Greatly on par. You?
I was gonna, like, are you going to ask me? 4.5.
Yeah.
On a certain day, I could be a 4.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
If you're feeling grumpy.
And actually, it's so hard because, as I've said, I just find it's so well made. So, so well made. But I think when a film is as well made as this, it does then leave it up to, let's talk about, right, we've got almost like the blank page of it's well made. Mm. Let's talk about more of the kind of storytelling and creative decisions. And it did just leave me cold.
Okay.
So, but I will say, the two films together, whilst amazing, put together, are an even better experience.
Yeah.
So I might experience with part three, when the trilogy's complete, when you watch it all through, I might be like, right, that's a better experience. But for now, I feel a bit cold.
Okay.
And I don't really care where Charlie's gone.
Oh.
Well, now let's unsheath the gaydar. It's we'll a wonderful piece of machinery devised by Ned's own hand, and we use it to rank all the films and TV we discussed based on their LGBTQ plus appeal. Let's see where the gaydar ranks Dune Part 2.
Right, let's have a look. Obviously, we are, for a nice change recently.
We're not competing at the top, are we?
No, we're competing at the bottom.
Yeah.
So we've got above Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny and below Leave the World Behind.
So I'd go below both of them. I can't even really say like anything's camp because I don't really
think there are a couple of LGBTQs in the cast, which is why it's not the very bottom.
Like, yeah, I can't even say all that was camp because I don't even think anything's particularly camp either.
No.
Like, even when you see the costumes in the setting, it's so serious that the tone of it, even with Lisa and El Gaib still going off it, none of it's camp.
No, it's not.
But sometimes you'll have like a really you might watch a Star Wars film and be like, oh, that character was camp. But there's nothing like that.
That's usually because they're like a villain.
Yeah, but even the villains in this, like Fade Rauther to me, is scary as hell. No. Like,
yeah.
I wouldn't say it's not a film that you're going to see for its LGBTQ plus appeal. It's a film you're going to see cinematic
excellence,
yeah.
And it's also a film you're going to see if you're a big old sci-fi nerd.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do like sci-fi, you know.
I never ever have labelled myself as a sci-fi fan, but I've also very rarely disliked sci-fi that I've watched, so I must be.
I think I prefer the fantasy rather than the science sometimes. Because I do find sci-fi can leave me quite cold quite a lot.
Right.
There aren't many warm and fuzzy sci-fis. Star Wars is, but that is a bit... You can really see where George Lucas got his inspo even more from this.
Yeah.
For Star Wars.
Yeah.
Like, you may as well have just plagiarised some of it. I know. It's like, how can I do like the Disney version of Dune? Right, I'll do it. But yes, it's not for.
Okay.
The queers, is it?
I mean.
Well, yes.
There's a right to take up space.
If you've got taste, then you'll like this film.
Yeah.
And that's all for this time. If you have enjoyed this episode of Gaze on Film, please subscribe, rate, and comment on your podcasting platform of choice. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram. What were those eyes for? Because I was doing well. Yeah. At Gaze on Film Pod. And check out our Letterboxd accounts, links of which are in the show notes. We love to hear your thoughts, so please do feel free to drop us a message. I have been Declan.
And I have been Ned.
And this has been Gaze on Film. Thanks for listening.
Bye. Bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.